Kendall calls the mama. I'm sure all the henchmen is around.
Welcome back, Kate Daly Show. Glad you're tuned in, listening. Go to katedalyradio.com for podcasts, and those are live recordings of the show, and you can actually share those. Shorts are about 13 minutes long, or you can get by the hour, about 42 minutes, and you can share. Also, make sure and visit the sponsors of the show. They're amazing, amazing people. And Dr. Diet, amazing. Get your B12 shot over there. I get one. And I love the B12 shots. They play a role in maintaining heart health and energy levels and healthy skin and hair. It boosts your mood, cellular longevity. What they can do is really counsel you and help you on what kind of diet's going to work for you, and then walk you through it step by step, and also be there for you. And hold that accountability, which is really, really the difference in success or no success. You always think you can handle it, you can do it, but I assure you, probably not. And so I will say this, make sure that you are getting some help from Dr. Diet, 628 Diet. They have truly helped me. I know they can help you. And I've had people come to me and say, oh my gosh, how'd you lose it? How'd you really lose it? No, I really did. I went to Dr. Diet. That's exactly how I lost it and kept it off. So make sure you're getting over there. You can join their Facebook page too. They have a special right now if you bring a friend. And so make sure you check that out on Facebook, Dr. Diet Wellness Center. So glad that you're joining me, and I feel bad for some reason that call dropped on the way out of that last segment of the show. Truly, there's some bullying going on, and the bullying isn't coming from the majority of people that they say it's coming from with the LGBTQ crowd. There's definitely an agenda, and it surpasses the human thing, is what I keep getting told. It's a human thing, not a political thing. No, it's a political thing, and the fact that our city is flying flags for several weeks before an event says a lot about how divisive they want the city, because there's so many people here that are not being represented and they feel it. This is a very small group. And so they keep telling Mayor Pike, oh, you know, you're the best mayor ever for doing this. That's coming from a very, very small group, you know, under 20% of our population, if even that. I mean, way, way below and here. And I'm telling you that it's not all the way accurate on how most people feel. Most people just feel like if you want to go have a little event for yourselves, great. But don't say that our city represents LGBTQ. That's not really fair, and it's not really fair in its representation. But I find that if you go up against that group, you get the bullying. They'll bully your business. They will go after you like no other. In fact, I find it really disconcerting that they say they're all about love and unity, and then they come across as the exact opposite. And I find that sad. It's really sad. Says a lot about the movement and who they are, if they're willing to go to those lengths. I wanted to talk a little bit about suicide. I know I got a letter from a parent who was talking about the fact that their elementary student was just sort of getting lambasted with all of these suicide prevention materials, workshops, come meet with us. Let's talk about depression. Let's identify you with depression. And really, this parent had a lot of questions, about this. Why are we doing this? What's going on? What's happening? And I have to agree. And so I'll touch on this a little bit, and I might touch more on it in the last hour of the show, because there's some very interesting statistics here. And the parent has every right to be concerned about this, because you're seeing a huge uptick in the programs, aren't you? Everywhere you turn, you've got a suicide prevention month or week or event, or in the schools they've set aside, you know, time for this, and really vastly expanding mental health in the schools. And I think there really is a reason that they're doing this. And so I'll go over that. But I looked into this. I did some homework on this, and this is what you're going to find. If you look up the statistics, in 2017, there were just over 47,000 recorded suicides, and that was up from 42,000 about 3 years prior in 2014. So in 3 years, from 2014 to 2017, they say it went up about 5,000 deaths in our nation, okay? We do have an increasing number of population. They don't really ever take that into account over those 3 years, but they're saying, you know, that it rose. And so it's adjusted for age, but they say the U.S. suicide rate increased. Now, this number is very, very varying, which is kind of strange because you can go back into records of 1905 and they got it pretty much nailed down. But for some reason, we like to vary the statistics depending on who you're talking to. Has risen from 1999 to 2014, 24%. That's what they like to. This is the number they tout all the time in all of the curriculums. And it went from 10% to 13%. Okay. And it says it's the highest rate recorded in 28 years. The problem with this is that they consistently only go back 28 years. They consistently only go back 28 years. The suicide rate, even from the mid-1800s, okay, has not actually changed a huge, huge amount. It's still in proportion to the same amount of youth versus the biggest age group of suicide, which is 40 to 49. 40 to 49 years of age, that is your biggest suicide group, okay? And we're constantly talking about teen suicide, but we only go back to 1999, which I find kind of interesting. It's actually, you have to do your homework to even go back to the 1950s to get those numbers. And so I was even looking at the mid-1800s, where people were writing thesis papers and such on really kind of going over the numbers. And while we were in the middle of a war, in the Civil War, they weren't really recording suicides as much. They used to get very, very graphic. And they went from a couple of perspectives. They went from the perspective of you know, kind of blaming or you know, kind of, I can't believe, you know, this person did this and this was horrifying that they did this, to more of a sympathetic avenue of perspective after the Civil War. But during the Civil War, there weren't a whole lot of numbers on the suicides. And they also talked about suicide mania. And they said that there were a number of instances throughout this wartime period and Reconstruction in which there was an apparent suicide mania within the United States in the summer of 1868. And they said that that the tendency to suicide amounts almost to mania. This was taken from the Daily Phoenix in 1868. There's been an average of one a day for a month reported by health statisticians. And so they said it seems to be on the increase. And this was clear back in the mid-1800s. And so the reason I'm citing this is because suicide mania is something to be concerned about. The more it's talked about, the more people consider it to be a problem solver, to be something that is normally aligned with how to deal with stress. Even though it's condemned in the materials, it is still talked about as a thing to be talked about when dealing with stress. Does that make sense? So I found this kind of interesting as I was looking back during this time period, but they were having the same kinds of issues back then. And the numbers weren't exactly the same, but suicide since 1900s has not really changed very much. In 1901, for instance, it was 10.7% suicide amongst the group that we're talking about. Now, it's interesting that they don't identify just teens, and I don't know if anyone's noticed this, but they go 15 years of age to 24 years of age. A 24-year-old and a 15-year-old are very, very different in the way they approach problems and deal with life and see life. But they put this group together, 15 to 24. And I find that kind of an interesting and odd way to project what this group's about. Now, this percentage, 10% back in 1901 per 100,000 people, it was at 10.7 to be exact. See how exact that number is? Right now, they say between 10 and 14%. They can't give you an exact number. But during this time in 1901, they can tell you exactly what it was between the ages of 15 and 19, and that was 10.7% committed suicide in 1901 per 100,000 people. And so we get a lot of numbers right now. Depending on what you're going to look at, you're going to get a rate of 14%, or you're going to get a rate of 10 to 13%, or you're going to get a rate of 10.5 to 13.5%. It seems as though no one can quite agree on what the percentage is. And you should ask yourselves why that is. Why are we always giving a span? In USA Today, they cited 33% rise since 1999. Like I said before in the opening of this particular topic, the span is interesting because it's wide, but they also only go back to 99 when they create all the headlines. And that should be honestly really looked at, because it really goes back to them saying it because of smartphones. Because of smartphones, kids are now, suicide is on the rise. Well, I don't know if that's the exact reason. And I don't know if it's exactly what you think when you think, well, being on social media creates depression, which creates suicides. That's not exactly it. It could be the distancing yourself from people. And sometimes the attention that you think you're going to get from having suicidal thoughts, or bringing that to somebody's attention, or with the attention given in some of these events that they have, sometimes might even spawn what they even called back clear to 1868, and that was suicide mania. Okay, suicide contagion, they also call this. And so here's the deal. If you go back into the 1990s, a lot happened in the 1990s that created what we have today in the school systems as far as suicide goes, suicide prevention. And there were some acts, there were some different things that happened that allowed, and it goes clear back to 1958, but not inside the school system in particular, up until the 1990s. And when I come back, I want to tell you what their findings were clear back in 2009, about a decade ago. And it's really unsettling what they came out with. And this comes from the School Psychology Review themselves on what they admitted about implementing the programs in school, why this isn't a parent-kid topic, and why the schools sort of took this up is kind of where I want to go with this. And then I want to go with what my thoughts, because I've had these kinds of concerns for a while, that the uptick in these programs, I'm not quite sure it's being represented the way it should be represented when you look at the stats and numbers. So I'll come back, we'll talk about this, but they had the Universal Suicide Prevention Programs, and those really started 1991, 93. They started experimenting with these types of programs, anywhere from 2 hours a year to half the school year talking about it. And I'll tell you what the findings were, because I was a little unsettled when I read these findings. I thought it was kind of interesting. You might find it intriguing, too, and something, too, that definitely is not talked about today. Definitely not talked about. Be right back on the Kate Daly Show.
There you go. Go.
Kate Daly Show. You know, I like to dive into the research machine, and I like to go over things like this, because sometimes it just sort of hits me wrong when I'm looking at something and I'm thinking, why are we doing this? Why are we doing this now? And is it changing anything? And is it doing anything? I actually went into the topic of suicide prevention with an open mind. I really wanted to know why, if all of the suicide prevention that seems to be on steroids lately, does that actually work? Is it causing more of a problem, or is it actually lessening the problem? And is it a problem? Is it a problem? That was one of my biggest questions. So I went in the Wayback Machine. And of course, I just wanted to let you know that the number has always fluctuated between 8 and 13% among teens to young adults. 8 to 13, or if you want to go there, you could say 14, you could stretch it to 14%. They're trying, you know, there, some people are trying to say 14% right now, but there's a lot of consensus that it's between 10 and 13% right now. But I could actually take you back to the 70s, back to 1980. It's always fluctuated 10 or 12% or back to 10 or 11. I mean, it's always sort of fluctuated. And so, here we have the Universal Suicide Prevention Programs, and this comes from School Psychology Review, from their own words, when they were reviewing this back in 2009, about a decade ago. And the programs really started in the school systems in the 90s, about 91. They were starting to sort of take target groups and see if this helped or worked. Now, when I say see if this helped, at the time, the suicide rate had always been fluctuating, so I'm not quite sure why they found that they really needed to jump on this, but there were a lot of things that were done during this time that allowed the schools then and the HHS and NIH to make this a crisis, okay? They started calling it a crisis, a call to action. The Surgeon General had a call to action to prevent suicide, according to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services in 1999. See how the numbers always go back to 99? Okay, just thought I'd tell you. Whenever you see an article, it goes back to 1999. It doesn't go back farther than that, which is, I find, kind of strange. So the strategy for suicide prevention was goals and objections for action. That came from the U.S. Public Health Service. Also have recognized the importance of youth suicide prevention to classifying it as an urgent public health priority. Even though the numbers weren't radically spiking, and year to year it changed a little bit, you know, back and forth, they were still wanting to call it an urgent public health priority. So, for example, in 2004, the nation's first youth suicide prevention bill, the Garrett Lee Smith Memorial Act, was signed into law. That was in 2004. And in passing the legislation, the U.S. Congress noted that youth suicide is a public health tragedy linked to underlying mental health problems, and that youth suicide early intervention and prevention activities are priority national priorities. Note that they called it the underlying mental health problem. Congress, 2004, said it was an underlying mental health problem. Now, back in 1868, they said it was because at the moment somebody felt like they weren't loved, or they had, you know, the person they loved didn't love them back, or I'm not quite sure you could go as far as to call that a mental health problem, in that a lot of teenagers have a hard time seeing what tomorrow looks like and everything is a big deal in the moment. I don't know that I would classify that an underlying mental health problem. But if you'll notice that U.S. Congress, that's what they said about that in the first act of legislation signed into law on this. OK, so they had started already experimenting with these programs because they had already actually put through some of these, and they started implementing it in health education classes only. OK, and when they started doing that, there was a lot of different, you know, reviewed studies and from their own results. From their own results in School Psychology 2009, 13 studies were reviewed, some only 2 hours, some half the school year. This was in the 90s. Only 5 studies showed promising evidence for statistically significant outcomes, and only 2 of the 13 demonstrated any strong evidence in that area, that putting that into the health curriculum was doing any good. The results for educational and clinical significance were even less encouraging. This comes from Zinnier and Lazarus study in 1997. Demonstrating promising evidence and no studies showing strong evidence. That's interesting, right? So you think in the 90s, when they decided to do this, even though there wasn't some huge spike, they decided to start with these programs and really get these programs underway in the school system, is what I'm talking about. By the end of the 90s, they were already saying that there was no studies showing strong evidence. Only 1 of the 13 studies showed promising evidence that it was actually doing anything. So then why did they have the call to action in 1999? And why did they go ahead and then start in 2004, even passing the first law, passing it into legislation, the Youth Suicide Prevention Bill? Kind of interesting, right? If it was already showing and they were already admitting that it wasn't doing much. Or anything at all. So They had selected and indicated suicide prevention programs, student screening programs, all kinds of different things here. And they said that it ranged from getting kids to talk about suicide or getting somebody to know that they loved them, and that they weren't really seeing much of a decreased youth suicidal behavior back in 2005. In 2006, they said, unfortunately, although increasing the number of referrals to treatments a primary goal of the screening programs, let me just reiterate that again. 2004, Congress says there's an underlying mental health issue. 2006, this is unfortunately, although increasing the number of referrals to treatment is a primary goal of the screening programs, there is currently no clear evidence of a linkage between increased referrals and decreased youth suicidal behavior. They weren't seeing anything, and this is even back in 2005, 2006. And that the screening programs have generally not identified effective procedures for encouraging large numbers of youth identified as being at risk for suicide engage in treatment. There's currently little data available about the cost effectiveness of the screening programs, as well as when and how often they are best used. And they said, for example, youth suicidal ideation is often transitory. A screening, so it kind of goes up and down. It's transitory. It's not always there, and sometimes it is, right? And if they get that early in the school year, it may identify a different group of students in the screening zone by the end of the school year. So they knew that it was always changing too. But I did find that pretty interesting. So let me tell you this: in 1975, right, or let's go 1974. 10.9% suicide rate from 15 to 24. That was 1974, 10.9%. In 1985, 12.9. In 1991, when they started these programs, 13.1. It had hardly even risen. And then in 2000, it was back down to 10%, 10.2. And they were trying to blame everything. Economy fluctuation, does it go up with the economy? Depression drugs, are they treating in a way that can actually promote behavior, suicidal behavior? You know, it's a good question. Mental illness, they were kind of going over all of these things. And so and this goes back to 1958, the first suicide prevention center came to the United States in Los Angeles, right? With funding from the U.S. Public Health Service, even though the numbers had statistically been pretty consistent, they were saying that they needed this first suicide prevention center. And then crisis intervention centers followed. And then in 1966, the Center for Studies of Suicide Prevention established the NIMH, the National Institute of Mental Health. I find it interesting that even though the numbers weren't really changing that much, because you had post-World War II, you had into the 50s, you had that the numbers just were kind of consistently usually around the same number, they took the Center for Studies on Suicide Prevention to then instigate the creation of National Institute of Mental Health, of the National Institutes of Health, the NIH. So the National Institute of Mental Health came after the beginning of forming all of the suicide prevention centers. And in 1970, they convened a task force in Arizona to discuss the status of suicide prevention in the United States. And they presented their findings in 1973 in Suicide Prevention in the 70s report, which also identified all these future directions and priorities of what the group was going to do with this. Because now you have a group of a government arm that needs to expand their job and needs to have a job. And so they have all these goals and all these directions. And in 1983, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention established a violence prevention unit that brought public attention to a really disturbing increase in youth suicide rates. Interesting, at that time. So there were a couple of spikes in the 80s. Not huge spikes. It's always stayed usually around the same, but some spikes. And then they established a task force on youth suicide. Okay? And then they issued all these recommendations in 89. So that was your precursor to the 1990s, because suicide became a central issue in the 1990s because we were told it was a central issue, not because the numbers had changed very much during that period of time. And so the UN then set forth all these guidelines, and they wanted to establish public and private partnerships that would be responsible for promoting suicide prevention in the United States. Anytime the UN gets involved, they get a little worried. The Reno conference was viewed as the founding event of the modern suicide prevention movement. And its findings in 1991, Surgeon General David Satcher issued his call to action to prevent suicide, which emphasized suicide as a serious public health problem requiring attention and action. Okay. But what I find kind of interesting about that is that he actually had some different thoughts about that, too. And I find that kind of interesting because he actually kind of backtracked that thought as well. And he argued that this increase, because he kept talking about it in this way, but he actually went back on that not too long after that. So it was kind of interesting. They kept talking about that, except that wasn't exactly what the findings were, what their results were. So that was kind of interesting to me. Bottom line, when Congress came out in 2004, even after the 1990 findings that the programs weren't doing anything, there was no reason for them. The amount of referrals to treatment for mental health, if somebody was feeling suicidal, did not decrease suicide in the 90s. So in 2004, right after the call to action by the Surgeon General and right after this new bill had passed, Congress then identifies it as an underlying mental health issue. So the parent in writing me was probably right on the money as far as wondering if the uptick in identifying suicide amongst the youth is part of the data that's being used to evaluate the youth. And that the wider that umbrella gets, the more kids under that umbrella could it ever be used against them. And like I said before, you know, and it's a great, it's a great observation, because with the reasoning that the suicide prevention events and counseling in the schools is going to do a lot, it's never been proven to do a lot. And there is the thing about suicide mania in causing more kids to think about it as a stress control mechanism, as it's normal, as this is, you know, these thoughts, a lot of people have these thoughts. And so can it cause the numbers to spike a little bit? The numbers are usually going to be about the same, but are they including now more under those same numbers? Does that make sense? Are they widening that umbrella, and are they widening the mental health umbrella for a reason right now that it's hard to foresee where they will take that data? And I actually agree with this parent that, yes, because nothing proves that this has done anything, and they've had all these calls to action despite the evidence that it didn't do anything, there is a concerted effort for the national mental health arm of the government to exist and to become prevalent and to get data. And yes, I think it has a lot to do with data, more so than we actually think it does. So there's some food for thought. And it is a very sad thing when a young teen commits suicide. It's an extremely sad thing. It's a sad thing when an adult does it, too. And so what I talk about right now does not undermine that. But we do have to understand what we're looking at in the context of history, I think, always. Be right back with...